Welcome to The Book Show, Ramona Koval with you on ABC Radio National. In 1998, philosopher Raymond Gaita's book Romulus, My Father was published. More than simply a memoir of childhood, it looked with the clarity of a child's view at the sometimes difficult yet passionate world created by his parents, disturbed and uprooted after the European War. In 1950, four-year-old Ray arrived from Germany with his mother Christine and his Romanian father Romulus, a blacksmith who was to work on the construction of the Cairncurran Reservoir near the tiny settlement at Barringup, central Victoria. They settled in a weatherboard house, Frogmore, on the isolated landscape that Ray fell in love with. Romulus, My Father was also an exploration of what it was to be a good man, the way Romulus was good. His story of bringing up his son when his wife Christine became overwhelmed with mental illness and despair was full of instances of what a good man must do in the face of his wife's situation. Christine had an affair with Mitra, the brother of Romulus's best friend Hora, having two children by him. Their stories ended in tragedy, with Mitra killing himself at the age of 27 in 1956 and Christine ending her life 2 years later on the eve of her 30th birthday. After some years, Romulus himself descended into insanity. The book was a great success and was eventually made into a film, but what must in many people's eyes be seen as a triumph has been a mixed experience for the author. 13 years after the publication of the book and 4 years after the film, Ray Gaita has published After Romulus. What happens when a philosopher who has written widely about truth is faced with telling the truth about real people in his family? And how does he deal with the views of his family from other people? Ray Gaita is a professorial fellow at the University of Melbourne and Professor Emeritus of Moral Philosophy at King's College London. And he joins me now in the studio. Ray, welcome to The Book Show.
Thank you, Ramona. It's good to be here again.
Would I be right in saying that After Romulus is a book about how to read Romulus, My Father, what happened after the book and the film was written, continuing the conversation, really?
Well, continuing the conversation, but not how to read it. I don't want people to think of it, especially a chapter called Character and Its Limits, in which I comment on the way people responded to their sense of what was particularly good about my father. And sometimes I say, I don't think it was like this, it was more like that. But I don't mean that to be a kind of authorial interjection. I wrote that essay in large part because I'd been asked a number of times, actually after film showings, that philosophers are not used to having one of their number on screen, even if it's a lovely little boy like Cody Smith-McPhee. So I might be asked to give a philosophical lecture somewhere, and then they say, would you mind speaking after the lecture at a screening of the film? And so I did, and during the course of that, I realised just how much I owed to my father and to his friend Hora, not just in a sense of what one should do to live a good life, but about the very nature of morality itself. And indeed, again, through their example, not so much through what either said, I learned from them things that are still very controversial amongst moral philosophers. One of them being that you can be morally severe in the sense of insisting, for example, that you be truthful about how to describe somebody's conduct in moral terms, and yet at the same time not point fingers or be judgmental. So my father, for example, never for 1 minute was prepared to deny that my mother, and in a different way, Mitra, had betrayed him. And if somebody would have said, you think betrayal is the right word? He said, yeah, let's call a spade about this one. But all his life, he remained friendly. Not all his life, because Mitra died, but all Mitra's life, he remained friendly to Mitra. And one of the things I try to celebrate more specifically in this book than in Romulus, My Father, was the nature of his compassionate response to Mitra's need, but more importantly, my mother's desperate need.
Because he said, this is the wrong thing to do, but I understand that there are other factors which drove them.
Yeah, but I don't know that he even thought too much about there being other factors. He wasn't a theoretician, so he wasn't weighing up the conditions of culpability.
But you don't have to be a theoretician to say, my wife is suffering deeply, and they are in this passionate embrace with each other, and that this is what they need at the moment. I mean, you don't have to be a philosopher to say that.
No, he. I say this in Romulus. At any rate, I think he also always thought that theirs was a doomed relationship. Not, I mean, one that would in which they were doomed to terrible suffering. And I think his response simply was, well, what else was there to be done? So it was a kind of, and this is a thing I talk about a bit, there was an ethically necessitated response. This was the sense of impossibility, that there was nothing else he could do, was an ethical necessity, but it was also compassion at the same time. And I contrast that with obligation. I'm going on a little bit about this, but just to illustrate that what I was trying to do in that particular essay, which is a kind of essay in moral philosophy, was to reveal how certain quite controversial thoughts in my own discipline are thoughts that I owe to my father, and I wanted in that essay to explore that, rather than to tell people, hey, you think character's an important thing? It's not. That, I hope, isn't the spirit in which that essay is read.
It was very important for you in Romulus, My Father, to tell the truth, and so much so that you were very careful about what you said, whether you remembered particular words that people spoke, whether you could say these people said that these words were spoken, and you didn't try to conflate anything or assume anything. I mean, you said perhaps this or perhaps that. Why was it so important for you to be careful with the truth?
Well, I think because instinctively, and I have to say instinctively because I wrote that book very quickly.
You said three weeks?
3 weeks, the first draft. But I think instinctively I knew it was a book that was a kind of witness to the values by which my father lived his life. People may disagree with this, but I think it's the nature of witness that it can't be, as you can't mix fiction with it, and you can't be careless about truth. You'll remember a time when you and I were both embarrassed by the Wilkomirski episode, where we were both enormously impressed by a book, and the way we were moved by that book depended absolutely on it being fact and not mixed up with fiction.
And then it turned out it wasn't.
It turned out not to be true, and the publisher for a while had the cheek to at least entertain the thought that maybe they would release it as fiction. Well, I don't think that... I don't think that the sense of my being a witness to my father's goodness would survive anything that looked like carelessness about the facts, and certainly wouldn't survive the addition of fictitious material. But I really want to add, I don't have a general view about the mixing of fact and fiction. I just think in this case it was out.
In your book, A Common Humanity, Thinking About Love, Truth and Justice, you quote Simone Weil saying, "The need for truth is more sacred than any other need." And this gives truth a more spiritual value, sacredness rather than simply something that is right or factual.
Yeah, well, Prima Levi writes, I also quote this in A Common Humanity, that he was disgusted by the way the political life of Italy had been polluted by the lies of the fascists. Now, polluted is a very interesting word. Only something that can be very precious can be polluted. If it's merely useful to you, you can bugger it up in all sorts of ways and reduce its effectiveness, but you don't describe it as having been polluted. And people can think about truthfulness in their own lives in those kinds of ways where it really matters that you be truthful about, for example, your past, even though your concern to be truthful in that way isn't because you think it'll make things better for the future.
You write about depending on Bach to keep truthful.
Don't ask me to explain that.
Please explain.
I can't.
You're playing Bach while you're writing because you say...
Not so much while, but afterwards. But it was because I knew that in a dramatic story as this one was, I had to resist any tendency to... In fact, I had a deep tendency to pathos, as it were, in describing what had happened to my mother, what has happened to Mitra, and so on.
Because it is a sad story.
It is a sad story, and I didn't want the sadness to disappear. But, I mean, I take vulnerability to pathos to be like a vulnerability to sentimentality, and not so much an absence of feeling as a distortion of feeling. And I listened to Bach to keep me truthful in that kind of way.
Because of the structure?
Because of Bach's structure.
Yeah.
I think in a lot of it, Bach's music, there's such wonderful and powerful feeling, but utterly disciplined in the sense of not yielding to any of those things, sentimentality, pathos, and so on. I listened during the day too to Maria Callas and My Mother Love, but I couldn't take too much of that without knowing that the book would be dripping with pathos.
Then the film arrives, the proposal for a film, and I remember your sort of struggle with being courted by many offers of filmmaking at the time, and you were very, very selective, weren't you? Tell me about your attitude to somebody else telling your story.
Well, I didn't want a film at all, and the only reason that Richard Roxburgh got the rights is because originally he asked, having come all the way from London, from Africa to London with two bottles of red wine, he got the rights because he asked only in the end for the rights to write a screenplay, my having refused him the rights to the film. And then one thing led to another, and over 6 years... The film was made. But it was many times during that I was prepared to say, let's call it quits, when we couldn't get a screenwriter and so on.
And what were the points at which you felt that you were struggling over that?
Well, I thought there were two things. Perhaps most especially, I think it's very hard to make a film about madness without bathos or sentimentality. And in this case, there are three mad characters, Vatsek, my mother, and my father. So I thought the chances of this coming out well were very small. And also, I began, because I thought that one of the things that mattered most to me about the book was to characterise the way in which my father could behave to Vatsek, who was visibly insane. In the film, he's not. In the film, he's more or less, as Richard Roxburgh describes him, an amiable, homeless man, right? Who cooks eggs in his urine. But he was visibly mad, and one of the things that I realised about my father, and indeed Hora, was that they responded to Vatsek without a trace of condescension. And I try in one of these essays in the book to say why I think that is so wondrous. I know that almost everybody would say we should behave like that, and I'm now 65 and I've met about 3 or 4 or 5 people who could do it. And in the book, in this new book, I try to explain why I think it's such a difficult thing and why it's so wondrous when it occurs. And I thought, well, if I've only seen a handful of people do this in life, why would I think actors could do it? So that was one resistance. And I think whether he did it intentionally or not, it was wise of Richard to portray Vatsek as merely a homeless, eccentric man, because I don't think he could have done what I would have wanted him to do, and then I would have been disappointed in the film, and I'm not disappointed in the film. I say in the essay about the film, when people ask me what I think of it, they're always disappointed because I say I like it.
Because why do you think they're disappointed?
Because they're so used to writers saying how they hate the films that have been made about their works.
We're on the Book Show on ABC Radio National. Ramona Koval here. I'm speaking with Raymond Gaita about his new book of essays, After Romulus. But when the film came out, I remember you being worried and that there was a scene that was dropped from the film that was in the original screenplay.
Yeah, there was a scene that was dropped in which have to talk about them as characters, Ray and Christina in the shack Frogmore before Christina has Susan. And she hears voices, and thereby making it clear that she's suffering from a form of mental illness. That scene was dropped, and so when people see the film and they see Christina's incapacity, so marvellously acted by Franco Potenza, to look after Susan, they think this is postnatal depression, which leaves them wondering why on earth she came in and out of Raymond's life and all the rest of it. And when I saw this, I told Richard Roxburgh that they would judge her badly. And he said they shouldn't. And I said, well, maybe they should or shouldn't, but the fact is they will. And I've read countless reviews of the film that sort of say things like, well, it was tough and it was a good film and the poor boy, a good thing that he got through it all right and came out reasonably okay at the end, especially having such a bitch of a mother. That's the sort of sentiment. And that upset me a lot, and it was no consolation for people to say to me, look, she's just a character in the film, because nobody says to me, look, Christine, Franco Potenza acted this character who has no existence outside the film really well. They all say, Christina, Franco Potenza acted Christina, your mother, really well. So I was deeply hurt by that, and I thought I might want to respond to it in some way. And that was
so
part.
So the film had been made by then, or did you know that film,
no,
that scene
no,
was going
I
to
didn't,
be dropped?
No, I didn't know until I saw a rough cut of the film that had been cut. I suspect that was all intentional, because they would have known that I would have resisted like mad at that stage. And maybe
was it too late to insist that it would be put back in?
It was too late. They did this right at the beginning of the shoot. And maybe the reason, I should on Richard's behalf explain, he thought that there was too much madness in the film and another mad scene would just alienate the audience and turn the film into melodrama. And given that he was making a feature film and not a documentary, that might have been a fair thought. So I'm not saying this to be critical of him, but still, it upsets me. It upset me a lot, and it was one of the many things that was driving me to write about my mother. It wasn't the most important thing, and in this book, I do comment on that, on the fact that the scene had been cut, but I leave it for an essay on the film rather than the long essay about my mother, because I didn't want in that essay about my mother to be any polemical tone or defensive tone.
Let's talk about that last essay about your mother. And it's the way you write, it seems to be have generated by a particular incident that you went through when you went back to Frogmore. Perhaps you could just tell us about that and read a little bit.
Yeah, well, my wife Yael and I have built a house not all that far from Frogmore, and indeed just over the hill from the camp to which my father was sent when he first came to Australia to build a reservoir, and where I had lived for a while with him, and the site of that camp, there's no longer a camp there, it's just over the hill. Hora, after he died, his children came to visit us, and they came with Hora's grandchildren, and that's a significant part of this story. So I'll read. That is Hora's children and their grandchildren, Yael and I, we spent the next day at Frogmore at the site of the camp. In mid-afternoon, they returned to Melbourne. An hour or so after they'd left, I felt edgy, tense, and very disturbed. On a hair trigger, I provoked a quarrel with Yael that evening. That made me even more agitated, because we hardly ever quarrel. I walked out of the house to my car, but with no conscious intention to do so. Again, with no conscious thought, I drove to Frogmore. I climbed through the wire fence surrounding the remains of the house. From there, with no sense of what I was doing or why, I walked half a kilometre from a paddock across a paddock, my feet crunching on the wheat stubble, almost white by the light of the moon, and I lay down next to a log in the swamp area. As is often the case, there was no water in it. More than 50 years earlier, a few days after she returned to Frogmore from the hospital in Malden, following a failed suicide attempt, my mother left the house without telling my father or me and spent the night in that same swamp, lying beside a log. As we had done on the night she tried to kill herself, we sought help from Tom Lilly, a neighbouring farmer who had a phone and a car. His son-in-law, who lived in Bendigo and who had come to stay overnight with Tom, put together a search party of locals and the Malden police. He was dressed in city clothes and an overcoat, which struck me as strange. He organised things in a voice that made me protective of my mother. Tom was disdainful of her, and I heard the same tone in the voice of his son-in-law. She came back to the house, I can't say she came home, the next morning. My father and I were hysterical with grief because we thought she lay dead somewhere in the paddocks, but she refused to tell us what she did that night or why. She told us only that she'd stumbled over a log and cut one of her shins. She said she had been demoralised and had slept the night beside the log. I doubt that she slept. Not even someone as psychologically and spiritually weary as she must have been could have slept in such a place. Searchlights pierced the cold black night. Rescuers shouted to one another. Over them she must have heard my father calling, "Crystal," and me screaming, "Morty." Standing knee-deep in another swamp, only a kilometre away from the waterless one in which my mother lay, watching 10 or so men search for her body, is one of the most searing of my childhood memories. I don't know why my father thought that she would try to drown herself in water that came at its deepest only to the knees of an adult. Perhaps it was because he was given to melodrama, or perhaps he thought that having come back from the hospital where sleeping tablets were pumped from her stomach, she had no more tablets with which to kill herself. What was I doing lying there that night, almost 60 years old, 47 years after my mother had killed herself? At the time I thought that I wanted to feel as she had, but could I really have believed that? Did I believe that I could abstract how that night might have felt for her, to be lying in the swampland of a desolate central Victorian plain that she hated, from the context of her life and take it into my own life? How could I separate out her mental illness, the particular quality of her displacement, the fact that only days before she tried to kill herself? Psychological forces strong and below the surface of consciousness walked me to the spot where I lay, provoked into declaring themselves by the presence of Hora's grandchildren, one of whom was the same age that I was when I came to the camp just over the hill from our house. Those forces were not seeking what I thought I was seeking.
Ray Gaita, they're reading from an essay in After Romulus here on The Book Show on ABC Radio National. So, but weren't you doing exactly that? And don't we try and do that? We put ourselves in the place of others whose lives we can't live, but we're trying to understand.
Yeah, we're trying to understand, but I think in this case, I couldn't really feel as she did, but what going to that swamp made clear to me, or on recollection, is that after writing Romulus, partly because I wrote it so quickly, I was sort of, it sounds strange to say, sort of enlivened by the drama of it. In fact, I sort of oscillated between exhilaration and depression when I wrote it. But I do remember coming back to Melbourne utterly exhilarated. Over the years, this was before the film, it wasn't the film that triggered this, I became more aware of the kind of quiet desperation of her life rather than the more dramatic episodes like an attempted suicide. And her lying there in that swamp that night became for me sort of emblematic of that more quiet desperation. And later on in the book I talk about how utterly terrible her last 2 years must have been after Mitra had killed himself, and she was going from place to place in Melbourne, suffering from mental illness herself, going from Melbourne to Ballarat, where she had previously been in a psychiatric hospital, to go seek psychiatric care, and there she killed herself. So it was that deepened sense of the desperate quality of her very brief life in Australia. It's still hard for me, actually, to get the time span right, because I still see it to some degree as a kid, and I think, God, it was a long time, but it wasn't. It was, in her case, 8 years.
Mm. You talk about Emmylou Harris as a musical accompaniment to this part of the story. What? Tell me about that.
One of my daughters, Katie, had given me for my 50th birthday a tape of music that she liked, and some of it she knew I liked, and so on. But I'd never heard Emmylou Harris before, and some of her songs were on that. And one of them, a song called I Can't Remember If We Said Goodbye, I played again and again and again. I had intended to write about my father, but I thought I might write on weekends, and nothing came of it. And I played this for about a week. I just played it again and again and again. And I said then to my wife, Yael, I'm going to write. And I rented, but I said I had to be by myself. And I rented a cottage near where I grew up. And though I went to write this book about my father, Romulus, my father, I started writing about my mother. So I should have realised a long time ago that this need to write about her was there strongly and wasn't really satisfied in the writing of Romulus.
Do you think it was that the views of other people, those reviews of the film, that made you finally put pen to paper about her? Because you say that it doesn't happen. You say it can never be a kindness to a child to undermine the love it has for its parents by suggesting that they are not deserving of its love.
Yeah, The reviewers were all full of professed compassion. Well, I professed sincere, let's say, for the boy in the film, me. But as I say, in trying to suggest in those reviews that this was a woman undeserving of my love and indeed of her husband's love, I thought this was no kindness. In fact, I think it's an insidious thing in general. I mean, I think, and one of the things I say in the book is that. Again, I wanted to, in the case of my father, be a witness to this, is that the nature of his compassionate love for my mother and his compassionate response to her need, while at the same time never denying that she had betrayed him, that enabled me to see her in a light where I could love her without shame. And that's a very, very important thing, because I knew how disdainful everybody was of her.
Love her without shame.
Yeah, without being embarrassed by the fact that everybody thought she was utterly irresponsible and so on. I became really aware of this, again, not in my own case, but through a series of accidents I became a kind of ambassador, that's what's called an ambassador, for an organisation called Mirabelle, which is a wonderful organisation that gives support to kids who've been orphaned or abandoned when their parents were drug addicts. And one of the sort of talks I gave at a fundraising thing, I emphasised this, that I'd seen Mirabelle doing this, and the wonderful woman Jane Rowe, who's the CEO of it, I said one of the things that's so wonderful about Mirabelle is that it recognises not only that these kids need to be loved, which everybody knows is important, but they had to be enabled to love, and sometimes what gets in the way of being able to love. Of course, it's psychological factors, traumas of one sort or another. But a certain kind of moralism can get in the way too, because you're encouraged to disapprove of your parents and join in the disdain for them that is felt in the community. And I felt that constantly in the case of my mother.
When you were a child?
When I was a kid. I felt that I was being invited to do this by people who were expressing their compassionate sort of sense of me, the poor boy, abandoned, etc.
You went to a Catholic boarding school, didn't you? And for those later years, I suppose, of being a child. And what was the attitude there?
To her, well, nobody spoke of her there. Although one of the things that I do write about in this book is that when my mother came to visit me at the school after not having come, I hadn't seen her for 2.5 years, not since Mitra's funeral, and my father at that stage had been committed to bringing another woman from Yugoslavia and to marrying her. And my mother came, and she said that she wanted to go back to my father, that she probably had only a year to live if the doctors were right. And she asked me to convey this to him. And I did, but only 3 weeks later when I went home for the school holidays.
So how old are you now?
How old were you then? I was going on to 12.
Mm.
And So I said to the headmaster, would you mind telling my mother if she were to come again that I don't want to see her? But I did say for the time being. And I knew this. I insisted when the screenplay was written, you mustn't leave that qualification out for the time being. But, you know, I realised only recently, probably a year ago, that maybe he didn't tell her
for the time being.
And it had been so important for me all my life that at least I'd said for the time being. And so I don't know whether he told her, and if he told her, whether she believed it
or whether she even heard it.
All those things, as it were prompting me to write. Because if that's true, I mean, let's say for the sake of argument, he didn't tell her, or she didn't hear it, or didn't believe it, then she killed herself a few weeks later. She would have killed herself thinking that she'd been abandoned by the man she would never, that she thought she could always rely upon, my father, and even by her son. So again, it was a matter of coming to see how terrible her life had been, and wanting to write about it. Why exactly I wanted to write about it, as opposed to just coming to see, and having written, why I should publish, I don't know.
And that Emmylou Harris song?
I still play it.
But isn't it about, I don't know if we said goodbye?
Yeah, I know. I know, I shouldn't have been so obtuse. There was a conference in my honour just recently in Adelaide, and a number of papers were on Ron Millers and so on, and a lot of people realised, long before I did, that I should be writing about my mother.
And now that you've written this, how does it help? I mean, a lot of people would think that episode with you going into the log and spending the night was a kind of breakdown.
Well, I don't know if I'd call it a breakdown, but I don't know if it helps. I mean, it's not. I've never had any time for the expression closure, but it's not as though I think this is over. It mattered for me to try to get it as clear as possible. In part, it mattered to me to write, I hope not too defensively about her, but that's in the essay about the film, because I wanted to say this is just not true.
Just in our last couple of minutes, there's another part of the film which wasn't exactly true too. It was about your half-sister. You've got two half-sisters,
yes.
And the film, because of the way it was told, I don't quite understand why, but it only has your mother giving birth to one child, and your other half-sister felt left out.
Yeah, the reason is that they had decided to have only one child actor, and they knew they couldn't age him plausibly more than 3 years, and so they could fit only one pregnancy in without undermining the whole dramatic structure of the film. And I resisted that for a long time, but I saw that it was inevitable. And again, I had to yield. This is not a documentary. I can't. Barbara, when she saw the film, there's a scene in the film where when Christina is killing herself and she looks at photographs, and there's one of Susan and one of me. And Barbara told me that when she saw that scene, she felt as though she'd been written out of history.
As you would, of course.
As she would, of course.
So, it's very interesting about art and about life, and I'm sure that your story has moved a lot of people to think about these things by seeing the film, by seeing the artistic depiction, probably asking themselves all the same questions that you raise in your philosophical works and in your memoir as well. But as you say, it's very complex for the writer, for the liver.
Yeah, it's complex for me because now sometimes the voice of Eric Banner intrudes when I'm thinking about my father, and Franca Potenza when I'm thinking about my mother. And so it can be, as well, everybody knows about the business of photographs getting in the way of your memories of a holiday. And now I've got a book, a film. And shit, now it's another book. That's a realisation.
Well, this new book of essays by Raymond Gaita is called After Romulus, and it's published by Text. And Ray, always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you, Romana.